Week 11 of the NFL season was full of drama and just a little bit of tragedy. Dak Prescott and the Cowboys might never lose again. Kirk Cousins cuts through the wind to lead Washington past the pack, and the Bengals lose not one, but two big-time stars on offense. How do they cope? We're going to talk about all that and much more on this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I'm here, as always, with Andy Benoit. Week 11 in the books. Thanksgiving coming up. We are thankful for the fact that the Cowboys are good again so that people like taking in media and shows like this.
And we got some good Thanksgiving games, too, because of that. Cowboys, Redskins, and the middle game now. And then the first game, Detroit and Minnesota for control of the NFC North. And then a couple of 5-5 teams in a big spot with Pittsburgh and Indianapolis in the night game. So this is a very good slate of Thanksgiving games. But I guess we have these Week 11 games to talk about first.
We do. It's a rarity to have three games with playoff implications on Thanksgiving, mostly because the Lions usually don't have a lot of playoff implications come late November. But nice little change up here. But you're right. Let's start with what just went down on Sunday.
Number one.
Cowboys, they're just never going to lose again. Cowboys are going to run the table. We will not see them lose. Our children will not see them lose. Our children's children will not see them lose. But let's focus on the play of one Dak Prescott. Fantastic again today. The Cowboys started a little bit slow, and then they just dominated this game for the last 35 minutes of it or so. And my question to you, Andy, I have very strong feelings on this, but I will let you go first. Is Dak Prescott legitimately in the MVP conversation?
See, I think asking that kind of ruins the moment with Prescott, because the answer is absolutely not even close. And that's so much more negative than what this guy deserves to be talked about right now. He's in the Rookie of the Year conversation. He'll probably lose out to his own teammate, which is a nice way to lose out. But no, he's not the MVP. And Bill Barnwell the other day made a case for the Cowboys offensive line as MVP, and that I think is starting to gain some traction. I don't think you can do that either. I don't think you can make a five-man unit MVP, because then what's to say we're not going to make the next year the defensive line of the biggest sack team MVP?
Yeah.
So I don't think the MVP resides in Dallas unless somehow you want to settle on one of those offensive linemen, because they're clear. That's what defines that team. And I don't know how you would choose between Martin Frederick and Tyrone Smith. So no, I don't put Dak Prescott in the MVP conversation. I put him in the conversation of a rookie QB who has great surroundings and has done a tremendous job of fully capitalizing on him.
Yeah. No, I had made the point this weekend in my column. I would put Ezekiel Elliott and I would put Travis Frederick and Zach Martin in the MVP conversation before Prescott. I did not include Dez Bryant or Tyron Smith in that because they both missed games this year.
Yeah.
Although, obviously, we've talked about Tom Brady as our pick for MVP, and he missed games for an undisclosed reason at the beginning of the season. So maybe a little bit hypocritical there, but yeah, I'm just, look, he's been great, and you can't really, it's tough to play that game where you say, well, if you put Dak on this team and you put this guy on this team, what happens? Because this is the team Dak is on, and he's doing what he's been asked to be do. He's doing what he's been asked to do. The thing is, you know, like early in this game, he was pressured a little bit. The Ravens did some stuff up front that actually created some very rare pressure on Prescott. They got in his face, and, you know, his throws were off the mark, and he missed a couple. You know, his ball placement's still a little bit shaky overall, I think. But, you know, he wasn't sharp early on. It took the Cowboys a little while to get going. But, you know, the entire second half of this game, he's just sort of standing back there, and he pats once, and he pats twice, and he pats three times. I don't even know if he has to. But he can, because no one's close to him, and it just, everything opens up for him, and it's a very nice situation to be in. But this offense is doing everything right now, and really they get into the second half of these games, and I just don't know how you stop them. They just wear you down.
Well, the more I watch Prescott, I think he does have a few. I agree with you about the ball placement. It's not as precise or consistent as you would like yet. And the other thing is, I don't think he's very quick and fluid getting into the deeper part of his progressions at this point. I think when it's, and you see this on film, and you have to slow the film down to watch this stuff. I mean, this is nuanced quarterbacking details, but this is what separates the Tom Brady's of the world. And if Dak Prescott wants to become in that class, this will have to get corrected. But when his first read is covered, he doesn't have a natural anticipation sense for where his second read will be and what it means. He has to almost like restart the process and just make the second read his new first read. It's like everything reboots. That's not unexpected with the rookie QB, and it's been totally masked by the tremendous pass protection he's had. He can afford to play that way. I think he's going to correct these things and get better, because the one thing he does have, and why I'm so optimistic about him for this year and moving forward, is he's very calm and poised in the pocket.
Yeah.
And so often the rookies that don't know what they're looking at, and sometimes he's one of them, they get frenetic in the pocket. They start to panic, basically, and their mechanics change. That's not the case with Prescott. Now, he's got to get sharper throwing the ball, too, and that is always an iffy proposition. Can you become a sharper passer once you reach the NFL? How much sharper? But that's where he's at right now. That's the story with this guy. But everything we're talking about, Gary, you have to get through that offensive line first. It's almost all academic. We ought to be talking about Dallas's offensive line, and there's not a group that's better than them, and they went up against a good Ravens defense today. That Ravens defensive line has been the best in the NFL against the run, both statistically and I think just watching film week in and week out.
Yeah. And look, one thing that caught my eye from this game was their first touchdown. You know, they were trailing 7-0 until late in the second quarter. They got down to the 5. They had a first and goal from the 5, and they threw it 3 times. Dak actually scrambled on the first one, but it was a passing play. He had a little miscommunication with Witten on second down, and then they rolled him out, and he fit in a really nice throw right on the front right pylon to Cole Beasley to get them on the board. And, you know, the Ravens had their opportunities in this game. It's almost like you have to create separation with this. I mean, it sounds stupid, but, like, you have to – if you have a chance to go up 14, 17, 21 points on the Cowboys, you have to do it. You can't let them hang around, because they are just dominating in the second half. And this was another strange game with the Ravens, where they only ran it 16 times, and they ran it well, and they ended up throwing it 30-something, 35 attempts, and then a sack for Flacco. So 36 dropbacks, another sort of backwards game for the Ravens here. And one other note from this one, Steve Smith, 1,000th career catch, 14th member of that club.
And
better be
Anthony
a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Anthony Brown, the Cowboys cornerback, is now the latest corner, young corner, in fact, to come away publicly declaring that he no longer respects Steve Smith. I don't know what Steve Smith does if they're out there on the field, but it seems like week in and week out, people go screaming from the mountaintops, the guys that play against him, saying, "This guy's a jerk. We can't stand him." But he's a very good football player. And Anthony Brown's had a nice year, too, by the way.
Yeah. No, Anthony Brown was good. I don't know if they took exception. Smith landed a block. I think it was on Anthony Hitchens. It wasn't necessarily – I thought it might have been a block in the back, but I don't know if I necessarily call it a dirty play. But I don't know. He's a boisterous guy, Steve Smith.
Yeah, and it's worked for him. He's had an excellent career. There's no arguing that.
Yep. Oh, one other thing with this game. The Cowboys, this was a great stat from CBS. CBS had this game. Yeah, this was AFC on the road. Cowboys have now beaten every other NFL team, all of the 31 teams, at least once. Ravens was the last team the Cowboys had never beaten. So they can celebrate there.
Okay, yeah. All right.
I thought that was a neat stat.
It's all right. It's an all right stat. It's good enough right to be on, but it's, yeah.
I thought it was neat.
Number 2.
Well, let's move on to topic two. This was the Sunday nighter in an absolute hurricane, it looked like. At least there were, it was a hurricane, and people down in Washington need to do a better job of disposing of the trash, because there were just a constant stream of, like, hot dog
like a
wrappers.
Giants and home game. Every Giants game seems to have a stray wrapper float across the across the screen on red zone shots.
It's like, when you're done, crumple it up, put it in your pocket.
70,000 people there, and probably 5,000 of them are inebriated, and another 5,000 are a-holes, and they're not going to throw their stuff away anyway. So that's 10,000 opportunities at litter right there alone, and they're buying more than one hot dog probably too. So I think that's a tall order. Those quarterbacks threw the ball pretty well for the windy conditions, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, Kirk Cousins and Aaron Rodgers were both just absolutely fantastic in this game, and Cousins obviously gets the best of it. It ends up being a 42-24 Redskins win here, but yeah, they were, you know, they even talked about it at halftime where it was like that one on TV, the left to right. They were saying, oh, you know, when you're going into the wind, you know, Mike McCarthy was saying, you know, you got to call a completely different game, but Cousins especially seems to have no problem throwing deep in that direction.
And that's interesting, because he has been a little bit of an inconsistent deep ball thrower over the years, but that's gotten better over the course of this season, in fact.
Yeah.
I remember early in the year we talked a little bit. He had some issues with some of those deep passes, mainly when the pocket crumbled around him. Now, his pocket has not been crumbling as much, and that's a big deal with him, because he's not a big-time arm strength guy, but he's a mechanical passer in a sense that if he has room to step into the throw, if he gets all of his body's mechanics working together, then he still can get the ball as if he were an arm strength guy. He can get it from A to B very effectively. So if you give Cousins room to throw, he's tremendous. And what do you do to give a guy room to throw? And Washington understands this extremely well. Play action does that a lot, because it slows the pass rush naturally. Often it moves the pocket, which inherently creates room to throw, because pass rushes are always designed for a stationary pocket. And there's no defensive coach that builds his pass rush to attack a moving pocket. The odds just aren't good enough that it'll work. So if you can get play action going, that really helps a QB like Cousins. And Gary, watching this team week in and week out, they have by far, I'm willing to say by far now, the best all-around play action game in the NFL, and that includes deep shots.
Yeah. And look, a big reason for that, you know, second year under Bill Callahan here, and it looks like they have found sort of that grinding feature back in Rob Kelly, at least the early down guy, replaced Matt Jones. Kelly had a big night in this one, 24 for 137. And, you know, just watching this game, when it got to be, you know, Packers scored to make it 29-24 with about 10 minutes to go, and it was kind of like, well, you know, we've seen this movie before. They left the door open for Aaron Rodgers, and he's going to come back and win this thing. But they slammed it shut, and a big part of that was Rob Kelly. He gets the Kira Sedgwick Closer Award of the Week, which I just made up.
Kelly is, I like it. Kelly is a notable upgrade over Matt Jones, and they trust him more, for one. You never got the sense they trusted Matt Jones completely there. And what Kelly brings is more quickness, the ability to change directions in confined areas. He's not as big as Matt Jones, but he still finishes runs. He's an above-average tackle breaker or run finisher. He's big by NFL standards still, or big enough, and he plays big and strong. So they found their running back. They've got a good third down back in Chris Thompson. They do a great job with their designs and route concepts, and when you do that, oftentimes you create mismatches in the middle of the field, which is why Jordan Reed and Jamison Crowder are their two most productive receivers this season. And then their ancillary weapons, all of a sudden it's Pierre Garçon and DeSean Jackson as their ancillary weapons. So this is a loaded offense with, as you mentioned, an offensive line under Bill Callahan that's markedly better than a year ago. Young guys, well coached, backups are even playing well now. This is a complete football team, Gary, and their defense has also become a lot more complex schematically. So this might be the most improved team in the NFL the more I think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and we should mention on the other side of the coin here with the Packers, they are just, I mean, they're out of healthy bodies on defense, and they're running short on the offensive line now as well, which was, you know, those were their two big strengths early in the year when it was All the questions were, when does the passing game get it right? What's wrong with the receivers? What's wrong with Aaron Rodgers? Now it's, you know, can they pull enough, I don't know, warm bodies together on the defensive side of the ball to stop anyone? Because Clay Matthews is back tonight. He was not quite Clay Matthews, but
no, and Seki,
you know, they end up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and Seki, the backup left tackle, outplayed him. And
yep.
A week after, he outplayed Everson Griffin, too, by the way. So it was a nice job by Nseki. But you're right. Clay Matthews isn't fully himself. Perry got dinged up in this one. It's a bad direction the Packers are going in, and they do not have the record to survive a bad direction right now. They're 4-6.
Yep. And look, they're two games out in the North. It you know, they're falling off. You know, you go 10-6, you don't necessarily get a wild card. And I mean, look, we shouldn't be talking 10-6 at this point anyway.
Yep.
But they are within two games of the two teams at the top of the division, and they get both those teams later in the year. They'll get the Vikings at home, and they'll be at Detroit. But you know, sort of running out of daylight here for the Packers, and the near-term future is not necessarily looking good, although it seems like the offense has kind of been a little bit better of late. So
it has the
kind
last
of a shame
weeks,
in that
yeah.
way.
It has the last 2 weeks, but there, as we've said, there are, 2 weeks does not override 2.5 years. There's still a week-to-week proposition in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. I've one other question for you, Andy, because I know you love talking about these things. The Jordy Nelson touchdown.
It was not
no
a touchdown.
Catch.
No catch. I hated that call.
I it made no sense to me.
He didn't think it was
that
a touchdown.
That has never been called like that.
Yeah, no. He didn't find it a touchdown. There should never be a debate, unless we're talking about if the ball hits the ground immediately as the guy's catching it, like if he's diving to the ground, going low on a comebacker or something. To me, there should never be a debate about catch or no catch. I know it's become this complicated rule, and it's all these nuances, and nobody knows. We've all known our whole lives. Until we started thinking about it, we always knew what a catch was. And there's not a person alive who's played any kind of competitive sport that would look at that and think Nelson caught the ball.
Yep. I agree with you, Andy. It was the same. Do you remember the Giants Patriots game last November?
Yeah, I do. Butler had that big pass defense in the back corner of the end zone to essentially win the game, as I recall. It was a big moment in that game, anyway. Yep, I do. It's the same. You're right. It's the exact same thing, and they got it right on that play, and they didn't get it right on this one. And they're so nervous about how they do the replay reviews, and unless it's irrefutable evidence, we're not overturning it. I thought that was irrefutable evidence. Sometimes common sense needs to be irrefutable too.
Yeah, and look, the Beckham play was ruled a touchdown on the field, and they came back and said it wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
I mean, and that's what
there.
Bothered me. And I mean, the split second stuff when you're seeing it real time on the field, yeah, you're gonna miss some of those. But it was the fact that it was the replay review was so inconsistent between the two plays. And granted, there have been more plays between what happened on November 18th or whatever last year and what happened on Sunday. But it just, you know, it got my goat. Is that a saying?
Yes, it is, and it got my goat as well. All the goats were taken on that. Forgotten.
Goats. Well, that's the goat roundup right there. And with that, we will move on to topic three.
Number three.
More bad news. A lot of bad news this week. AJ Green, hamstring injury. The fear is that he might be done for the year, and that is especially troublesome for a Bengals team that drops one at home to the Bills today. They are now sitting at 3-6-1. As, you know, just like the NFC North, the AFC North is not particularly good. It's the 5-5 Ravens, 5-5 Steelers are tied atop the division right now, so there is a little bit of time left. But the Bengals already were having a lot of trouble on the offensive line, and you know, AJ Green coming out of this lineup, obviously, you know, Marvin Jones is no longer there. Sanu's no longer there. I don't know. I don't know if they have enough firepower to hang in there this year.
Well, they've been able to statistically replace those other receivers, at least, the production, for the most part. The production's kind of just been distributed elsewhere, which tends to happen, but it's not the same offense overall. Someone catches the balls, but that doesn't mean it's the same offense or the same flow and effectiveness. I don't think they survived losing AJ Green. They had lost Giovanni Bernard to an ACL as well. So you could argue the only two creators that they have on this team are now gone. Eifert might be a third creator, but you have to scheme him open. You have to get him in the right spot in the formation. Bernard out of the backfield could dictate and create his own space, and then Green over the top could influence coverages when he aligned out wide. They lose both of those dimensions now, so they have less talent, but it's also going to be harder to scheme as well.
You know, we had kind of thought coming into the year, at least I thought coming into the year, when you looked at this team and you know, they lost their number two and three receiver, and you had Eifert out for the first 2 months of the year. It seemed like it might be, you know, a lot of Jeremy Hill early on, and that never really played out. Now, obviously, Hill is going to be relied on a lot more going forward, because they're sort of running out of bodies here. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how this team. Yeah, you remember when they played in Indianapolis when everyone was out? They were missing Green. They were missing
Week 7
Eifert.
Last
they were missing someone else too. And
yeah. Oh, and, you're talking about the playoff game?
The playoff game 2 years ago.
Yeah.
That's
and they didn't
to
win
me.
That
that's
game.
What this is sort of devolving into.
Yeah. No, you can't. Because they're not going to survive this. It's and not with their offensive line playing the way it has been as well. So it's an unfortunate break. Look, it happens to every team. This team had the fewest injuries in the NFL last season, so they've been on the other side of this equation and enjoyed the fortunes of good health. Now they're not on that side of it.
Yeah. And this was still a winnable game for the Bengals. Mike Nugent doing his best to create history today. We had the most missed extra points ever in 1 week, 12 of them. Nugent missed two. The Bengals were in field goal range at the end, but they needed a touchdown instead. They were down four instead of being down two, and that's how it played out in the end.
The NFL needs to be careful about this extra point thing, by the way, because what they don't – well, maybe they've thought of it, but what people never talk about – is how important it is that a touchdown be worth more than two times what a field goal is. If a field goal is worth three and a touchdown's worth six, that makes a field goal much too valuable, because you can that's just not a good balance. That's what the extra point does. It makes it so you can't just tie up a touchdown with two field goals. If you're going to have a bunch of six-point touchdowns, you're going to get a lot of faulty outcomes. I think they ought to do away with the extra point completely and make touchdown an automatic seven with an option to go for two. I don't like these six-point touchdowns at all. It's too hard to score a touchdown in the NFL. You should not get only two field goals worth of points for that.
I'm fine with that. I was behind the – I think NFL Blitz used to do this on the old video game where you just get seven. You score a touchdown, you get seven. I was all for that. But I do think this is better than the – you know, the 19-yarder that was sort of a, you know, it's the moment where you go go urinate.
Well, and the problem, if we're going to institute NFL blitz rules, that game was not always conducive to some of the safety standards that we have today. So we wouldn't want to label it that way, but yes, they had it right on that video game. That was like 4-on-4 football too, wasn't it? You had like four.
It was
guys
a weird game.
Field.
I never got into it, but I do remember that about the. About the extra point from NFL Blitz, which is a very important thing to know as you go through life. So the Bills, on the other hand, they move on to 5-5. They are still, you know, it's going to be the wrong year to go 9-7 if they get there. But they lost LeSean McCoy in this game. It looks like he's going to be out for a little while. So nothing particularly good happening there either. The one plus for the Bills is they don't have to deal with the Patriots again this year. But we'll see what they can get done down the stretch.
Number four.
We will move on to topic four, and that is the Jacksonville Jaguars, who they are just the saddest story of 2016. This was supposed to be the year. This was supposed to be the year where the Jaguars and the Raiders broke through and were, you know, not necessarily Super Bowl contenders, but playoff contenders.
Yep.
Now, the Raiders have obviously made it. The Jaguars, I mean, you know, you collect all this talent, all these high draft picks, all these free agents coming in, and they're bad. And they dropped one again today in dramatic fashion in Detroit. 26-19, Lions is the final.
It's what they've got a dead man walking at head coach there now, unfortunately, too. And everybody within the NFL was rooting for this team coming in because they want Gus Bradley to succeed because he treats people, not just the media, but his players and coaches, and they just treats people the way we all aspire for people to be treated. So they want him to win, and it has the nice guys not finishing first here. It's not working out. I think they've got no choice. I'm not saying you fire Bradley tomorrow, but you've got no choice but to make a change, most likely. The tricky part of this whole thing, Gary, and the Lions wound up winning this game with a punt return touchdown and a pick six
Well.
It's that pick six, though, that gets to the tricky part, because that stemmed from a very bad Blake Bortles pass, another wobbler pass. It was also off target, and that's been the story with him this season. It's bizarre. We're seeing a rising star quarterback regress to a point that is well below where he was as a rookie. I mean, he's a bad quarterback right now, and it's the simple throwing of the football that's become the problem, and the more erratic he's gotten there. And look, he's up and down. Some of his ups are amazing. He'll still throw four or five big-time passes a game, including this game, and then he'll have four or five that go the other way, and those have been costly, and that's not a good trade-off. That's not you can't do 50% of highs and lows. You got to be about 90-10 there at best. So I don't know what you do with Bortles, because what's happening now is his decision-making starting to suffer as well the more he's pressing as a passer. He's not been a very good decision-maker the last few weeks. He's not seeing the field as with the same clarity.
They got to – and this is – and again, Gus Bradley's a great guy, and he's a good coach, and someone's going to pick him up as a defensive coordinator, and he's – you know, I hope he gets another shot down the line, just like a lot of these successful head coaches you see when – you know, it's their second time around when they figure out how to get it done. I feel like every week they send Bortles out there, it's just digging deeper. They're just digging him deeper. He's got to come out of the lineup. They have to completely reprogram the guy. Every time you send him out there, it just not only from a confidence standpoint, but these mechanics, which are just ridiculous. I mean, it looks like he's you know, in a full windup with the bases empty every time he goes to throw the ball. And it's the more he does it, the more ingrained the bad mechanics become, and the more difficult it will be to sort of pull him back. And if you know, if he hasn't already fallen over the edge, and if he's not already, you know, too far beyond the last exit here, I mean, they can't keep on running him out here. And I don't know if they're only running him out there because they don't want to admit that something has gone horribly wrong.
I think they want him to
maybe
play
that's
through
a reason.
It. I think they want him to play through it, and I don't think that's. I kind of agree with you at this point. Is he's not playing through it, and you do run the risk at some point of this becoming insurmountable. And off season can change some stuff, but how much stuff? It might be best to just sit him down and let him see the game from a different perspective now.
Because look, next year is the last year of his rookie deal. So obviously you're going to have to make a decision on him after next season. And, you know, it's you got to start reprogramming the guy now. And you can't do it while he's going out there and playing every week, because it just all these terrible habits just keep on getting, you know, just hammered in there more and more and becoming part of his muscle memory. And this is really a bummer. This is the saddest topic we have ever had on the show, Andy.
Really? Okay.
I think so.
It's a struggling football team.
It's very sad.
Number five.
So let's move on to topic five, which this is a very negative show this week. Colin Kaepernick.
It was kind of that kind of week. We had some. It's not us. It's the world. This week that's presented.
There were some bad injuries this week too. But
what's so bad about topic five here?
Well, we're talking Kaepernick. I mean, not surprisingly, the 49ers were not particularly competitive against the Patriots. It wasn't a blowout. This wasn't a game that was done right away. They hung around for a little while, and eventually the Patriots just pulled away in the fourth quarter. But yeah, what are you seeing out of Kaepernick at this point? Because obviously coming into the year, the curiosity was, well, you know, does a Chip Kelly offense save Colin Kaepernick? And we really haven't talked about the guy, and you know, he's had the other stuff to talk about, but we haven't really talked about his on-field performance to this point.
His on-field performance, I'm more encouraged by it than I thought I would be. I'm not a Kaepernick guy. It's not personal.
Yeah.
I'm not a Kaepernick fan. I'm not a fan of the quarterback. I think there are big-time flaws there. Mechanically, the way he reads the field, he's not very quick at that, so you have to cater to that. And the nice thing is Chip Kelly's system does cater to it. It has simplified the game for Kaepernick without redefining what it is. They've done a nice job with that scheme in San Francisco. I think they've done they get guys open through design, especially against man coverage, trips route combinations, so three receiver combinations, which often means you can run them to one side of the field and the quarterback only has to read that side of the field. It's a well put together offense, and there's an emphasis on mobility at times as well. We all know that about Kelly's scheme. So Kaepernick fits it in that sense. The reason I didn't think he could run it going into the season is that you do have to be a prompt decision maker. You can't just waffle back there in the pocket and read all day and break things down and make a play. That's not the way that offense is set up. And Kaepernick's not naturally that kind of guy, but we've seen signs that he's starting to become that a little bit. Now, let's say he can become that. Let's say he becomes a prompt enough decision maker that they can keep playing with him, because they're going to keep him in there this year. He's on that kind of path. Then the question is he a good enough down-to-down passer? Is he good enough in precision accuracy? Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical about that. And also, he might be a prompt decision maker, but is he making the right decisions? And right now, he's making decisions quickly, but they're still 60-40 for correct and incorrect, and that's not the ratio you want. So that's the Kaepernick report. It's all better than I thought it'd be, though, but it'll be interesting to see how they feel about him as well. And these next few weeks are big for him, because I imagine if he shows significant progress, and I don't think he will, but there's a chance he will, so it's not impossible, I would imagine they might consider having him back next season, depending on what they feel about this year's draft class and who is available at free agency.
Yeah, and look, he's, you know, from a talent standpoint, he's not a bad guy to keep around as a one-year placeholder. If you take a guy who's maybe going to need half a season before he can get on the field, and I think we're seeing more and more you know, they're not all Dak Prescott's. Sometimes you get guys who need a little bit of time to prepare and work. And look, yep, when you get these guys on the rookie deals, you get them cheap. So if you're paying your backup a little bit more, that's something you can deal with. Kind of like in Dallas, where you have, you know, Dak makes, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm guessing like, you know, $800,000 this year, and Romo as the backup is pulling in $19 million, and that's just fine because you're paying your top two quarterbacks $20 million.
It's interesting you mentioned Prescott, too, because overriding issue with Kaepernick has always been, it's the one I didn't touch on, is he doesn't have natural pocket poise, and that's what Prescott has in abundance.
Yeah.
And what I've also been encouraged is we've started to see a little bit of Kaepernick moving in the pocket better. He's not going east and west in the pocket as much. He's more willing to climb it and go north and south. Now, he's not great in that realm yet, but at least he's playing in the pocket. He's starting to color within the lines much better than he has before as well.
Okay. And, of course, this was business as usual for the Patriots, even without Gronkowski. And they played – they had some nasty rain coming down out in the Bay Area today. But, yeah, the Patriots, comfortable 30-17 win. It did – you know, it was a 13-10 game going into the fourth quarter. So it's a little unfair for me to say that this wasn't in doubt, but it wasn't really in doubt.
Well, Patriots controlled possession a lot of the times. They ran the ball effectively enough. What the difference in this game was that Tom Brady made a handful of big throws late in the down, which is not his game. That's not how Brady usually beats teams. He's been doing that more this season, though. We've talked about some of the scrambles that he's had. He's not a scrambling QB, but about once or twice a game, he's been moving the chains with his legs. The other part of that, and the more important part, is he's also extending plays and stretching the field with his legs by extending those plays. And he did that a number of times in this game. The Niners were not a blitzing team. Most teams don't like to blitz Brady, so he has opportunities to extend the plays. It's become a more vertical offense this year overall, though. Brady's throwing downfield more than I've ever seen him throw downfield. And in this game, he did it even with Gronkowski out. And Gronkowski's usually their downfield guy because he's the one running the seams.
Yep. And can I tell you that I am excited that Malcolm Mitchell had a big game today?
Why does that excite you?
For two reasons. One, I like Malcolm Mitchell, and he has a bit of a backstory. He switched positions a couple of times at Georgia. He was the guy. I don't know how well people remember this, but this was probably 2013 at this point. I might have the years wrong, 13 or 14. But Todd Gurley scored a long touchdown for like the first score of the year in the opening game for Georgia, and Malcolm Mitchell tore his ACL during the celebration, and Mitchell was their number one receiver at the time, and that was a very sad and tragic thing. But Malcolm Mitchell, I've never actually interacted with the guy, but I know through other people that people just say he's the nicest guy on the planet. We have a writer on our staff who was doing a Gurley piece and was having trouble tracking some people down, and I was like, you know what? When Gurley tore his ACL, Malcolm Mitchell was like consoling him on the cart on the way out, and I was like, just get Georgia's like student phone book and just cold call Malcolm Mitchell. I hear he's very nice, and sure enough, yeah, very nice guy.
It worked. Okay, well, absolutely. Good. That's good to know.
Yeah, so he's a guy worth rooting for. I was glad he had a nice day today, especially since he probably got reamed out pretty bad for a false start late in that Seahawks game.
But, he filled in for Hogan today, who was out injured, and he did have a very nice game.
Yeah. So that's a positive thing.
Number six.
Another quarterback to discuss here. Jared Goff made his debut. Rams-Dolphins. This was, you know, they didn't give him a very long leash here. This game plan actually kind of reminded me of watching Dak Prescott. Everything comes back to Dak Prescott, apparently. But it kind of reminds me of watching Dak Prescott in the opener, where it was very, very conservative. And they got a little bit going on the ground today, which is obviously very good news for LA and Todd Gurley. You know, I mean, the guy's been kind of MIA for the most part
totally
this year. He's been out there. He just hasn't been able to run anywhere.
He hasn't had a chance. That old line has been horrible in the ground game this season.
I mean,
I don't like to say that about old line, but it's that simple. Sometimes it's that simple. They try to run inside zone, which is about as easy of a the most straightforward run you can get. Two double teams right up the middle, go north and south. They don't do that well. They can't do that.
And look, I'm a resident fantasy dork, so I hear from a lot of frustrated fantasy football owners who have Todd Gurley and they're upset with him over the statistical output. And all I can say is, I mean, if you before the season had traded Todd Gurley to Dallas for Ezekiel Elliott, you know, everyone would have a much different outlook on those two players right now.
Yeah, Gurley has ran well for the most part. Now, I thought he ran better early in the season than he has as of late. Maybe that's to be expected, though. When a guy hasn't had anything go his way, you probably can't help but try to change your run style a little bit, try to do too much. When a running back struggles, I would imagine the first thing a coach tells him is, trust the play, trust your blocks, let your blocks develop. Well, you're just a liar if you say that to Todd Gurley. So I don't know what you do in that scenario.
Yeah.
And as far as Goff, I haven't seen this one yet. I'd like to see the film to see how they coached him or how they manage the game for him, but they've done a good job there in Los Angeles with first down passing play designs and first downs where you get the best most favorable passing scenarios because you get a predicted coverage. If you're the Rams, you're going to get a lot of eight-man boxes because your only dynamic player is your running back, so teams load up for him. And so I'll be curious to see what kind of first down pass designs they did. With Keenum, they had a good variety of stuff, play action, not to get too much into the nuts and bolts, but three-level stretches where there's a deep guy, an intermediate guy, and a shallow flat route all to one side of the field. They're good with that. I'd like to see what they did with Goff. And Miami, by the way, came back. They had to play in comeback mode. So Adam Gase had to throw the ball again, which I'm sure he enjoyed scratching that
yes.
itch. It worked out for him, too. That's a good win for Miami.
It was a nice win for the Dolphins. And look, you know, the Rams, they were in position to win this one, obviously. They were up 10-0 with 5 minutes to go. And,
that hurts to lose that kind of game.
It was not only that, it was the way they lost it. It was a lot of dumb penalties down the stretch. They missed a field goal with about 7 minutes to go here that would have stretched that lead just a little bit more. And yeah, that's what it came down to. There was one, as I was watching this game, and you could sort of see the wheels starting to come off for the Rams after the Dolphins, Rams had missed a field goal, Dolphins came down, scored, made it 10-7. And the Rams, you know, there were 4 minutes left, so they're in their 4-minute drill, you know, 4-minute offense here. And the drive started with a 5-yard run. And it was kind of like, you know what? They got a chance to hang on anyway. And they line up for 2nd and 5. They're obviously running the ball. Lance Kendricks is lined up way outside. You know, he's the furthest receiver out on the right side of the formation. False start. And it just threw the whole thing off schedule. And by the way, this game started with Lance Kendricks' false start. And it was such a dumb penalty. And it was kind of like, as soon as it happened, it was like, you know what? They're going to figure out a way to lose this game, aren't they?
That's how it happened. You do. That's a part of the formula for doing that. Penalties will do that to you.
Yeah. But this was also, Tannehill was good down the stretch. Devontae Parker was excellent down the stretch. He took this game over on the last drive and ended up catching the game-winning touchdown. So. I don't know what you can really read as far as Goff's future off of this game. It was very conservative.
You don't want to do that. You don't want
to. And look, they were in position to win the game. They should have won this game. It would have been ugly. There were 18 punts in this game, but you know, this was this should have been a 10-0 or 10-7 win, but it was not.
Number 7.
And with that, we'll go on to topic 7, and a team that is winning games right now, that is the New York Giants, who have very quietly reeled off 5 straight.
Have they really? Yeah, I guess they have. They're a 7-3 team with a winless Browns team up on the docket next for them.
Yeah, I guess it's just because of the Cowboys. I mean, they have a chance to. They haven't played the Cowboys a second time, right? I'll look it up right now.
No, they haven't, and. It's a defense that's getting better there in New York. We spend all the – I was talking with our producer, Matt Javia, about this before the show, about this team's playoff chances, which is a conversation that sneaks up on you because, oh, wait, this team's – yeah, they're 7-3. All we talk about is a negative with them because their running game is so blatantly bad and blatantly uncreative, and their passing game I think Manning's mistakes get magnified because of just the way they get presented, sometimes where and when they happen. But their passing game has not been dominant or consistent yet, and their defense is not anything you write home about. But everything in this equation, except maybe the running game, so the passing game and the defense, it's improving at a gradual pace week after week, and with each passing week, they're also getting a better feel for who they are and what they do well, which is why they keep improving. So there's a formula for that. That's how you build long-term success, or that's how you build sustained success on into the holiday season at the end of the NFL season. It'll be fun to see how that plays out. It's going to come down to that defense, though, and at some point, their pass rush is what dictates how well they play defensively, and they've had to be a blitzing defense. And I wonder if that will be enough for them, if they can keep winning by being a blitzing defense. Steve Spagnuolo, when he blitzes, their D coordinator, he goes big, he goes large, and that can bite you sometimes as well. So yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't chart it, but I thought they did a little bit less blitzing today, and the two edge guys, Vernon and JPP, had really good games. So they're things are coming together kind of nicely.
If those guys get going, though, that's a different it's a different discussion too. And those are the guys they expect to get going because that's who they're paying the money to.
Their running game statistically has been better. I think Perkins and Jennings have both run the ball better individually the last 2 weeks, but they also, you know, they're doing some counter stuff. It looks like they're getting, I'm not going to say creative, but a little more creative with what they do in the running game.
Well, the problem is they're a three-receiver offense, so they don't have a fullback in there, and so they don't have the ability to create new gaps after the snap. They don't have anyone they can put on the move. You said they run counter. The counters would have to be with their offensive linemen then, so it's just everything's less dynamic because they have one less body, and the other thing is their tight ends are not good blockers. So it's such a limited run game in that sense that they might get more creative with the plays they call, Gary, but they don't have the bodies to be – they're still easy to play against. You can only do so many runs out of a one back, and it's all shotgun too. So the counters are even less of a – less dimension because the quarterback's not moving on them. I don't know. Are you trying to be positive, or are you really a big fan of their running game moving forward?
I'm not a big fan, but I think it's – I think it has – improved. I don't want to say significantly improved. I think it is noticeably improved. Maybe it's gone from a D to a D plus.
Okay. Well,
maybe,
you know,
a C minus.
Sure. Jennings had 21 for 85 in this game. That's not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's yeah. There's some sustainability with that. I am not optimistic overall still. I think this is a passing team, and the one benefit of being a team that runs out of three receivers is you do run against a lighter box more often. A lot of times the team's defense will have to remove a linebacker to walk someone out over your third receiver. So there's pluses and minuses to everything.
Yep. Well, they started slow today, and then, you know, they were pretty well in control of this one from the probably mid-second quarter on, end up getting the 22-16 win over the Bears. Cutler tried to bring the Bears back late, and they just couldn't, they couldn't do it. They're no Alshon Jeffrey, and they just don't have the team right now. But with that,
number 8,
we get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters. This is the 10 Things Podcast Mailbag. All right, first question here is coming from Joe Fitzgerald at Surge Buster. He asks, are the Bills or Dolphins better equipped to push the AFC West teams for a wild card spot? Joe then mentions he is a fan from Australia. And as you know, Andy, we are huge in Australia. Or at least I'm going to say that enough so that it sticks at some point.
And there's no way to verify if it's true or not, so that's fine. I would keep saying it. And we appreciate Joe listening. I would answer the question with Miami. I think these are both running teams now, so their quarterbacks are complementary players. I am a lot more I have more faith in Tannehill when it comes to big moments. When your running game doesn't work and you're now suddenly in 3rd and 10,
yeah.
I take Ryan Tannehill over Tyrod Taylor in that scenario. And I think Miami's defense is quietly on the up and up right now, or they're on the rise. It's a good and it's an improving defense at all three levels.
Yep. I mean, Bills might be a little more interesting if Sammy Watkins does indeed return, which, I don't know, there's some smoke there. We'll see if he makes it back, maybe in December at some point. But yeah, I agree with you. And then not to mention the Dolphins are a game up at this point. Next question is coming from Itamar Avidan at Dr. Evil Worths. It's a strange. We've had a question from Itamar before, and I don't know how to say that Twitter handle. So it's just from Itamar. Let's see. Due to his off-coverage ability, shouldn't Kansas City try Marcus Peters at free safety just to see what it's like? You can take this, Andy. My basic answer is, you know, corner's the premium position, and obviously he's a great corner, and you don't you don't move him off of there.
I agree with you. It's, for one, they've got a lot of safeties already. They're set at that position. But let's talk about it in the abstract, because I think that's what this question is suggesting. You don't want to do that. If those positions are totally different, and what makes Peters so unique is he has an ability to read a wide receiver and a quarterback simultaneously. And so that's part A. Part B, he can transition out of his back pedal or out of his squat position very well. He's quick. He's athletic like that. So you have a guy who can read a receiver and the QB, read the passing lane, and then transition and make the jump on the ball. That's a totally different equation than being free safety, where your job is to read the whole field. You read the QB, but you have to read all the routes and act accordingly. They're not really comparable. And then your transitional movement is not as big a deal at free safety. It'll help, certainly. I mean, good transition skills will help at any position. But range and angles to the ball and route understanding, that's what becomes important. And so that's why I think a lot of times guys become free safeties later in their careers. They start to slow down, but they are smart enough. They've seen enough football that they can still read the field well enough to have the range to be effective. So I would never consider, and they'll never consider moving Peters, not for 8 years or so. And mm-hmm. It's rare that we see a cornerback with playmaking ability move to free safety. The only one I can think of who has is McCourty in New England. I believe he had a lot of interceptions as a rookie, if I recall, and he became a safety, but that's an unusual circumstance.
Yeah. Next question coming from Thornston Leowald at T Leowald. For teams like Green Bay, we are always saying that the offensive scheme doesn't help the receiver. They have to win their one-on-one. What is the benefit of running such a scheme?
The benefit is you can spread the field more. You use the whole width of the field, which you can do with route combinations as well. San Francisco under Chip Kelly, they do that with route combinations and widening the field. But you spread the whole field, and then if you have a quarterback who's a good progression reader, and I don't think Aaron Rodgers, that's exactly his game, but his game plays out that way. He's so freestyle-y that if you have a QB who doesn't play on time, he's better as an offbeat player than an onbeat player, then those isolation routes are more helpful because the timing's less significant. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
Well,
I hadn't thought of the quarterback aspect of that. So that's
It would play, because the other team that does a lot of isolation routes is the Buffalo Bills, and they do that because they don't believe Tyrod Taylor is a good anticipation passer.
Yeah.
They don't think he sees the field that way. And so if he doesn't anticipate and he doesn't see coverages through that precision and that kind of – or that prism, I mean, then you don't want to be giving him route combinations, because that's not how he's going to process it. You want him to just look from one guy to the next, and that's what isolation routes will do, and that's how they play with Rodgers. The funny part is we're saying he doesn't play on schedule enough, but when we or he doesn't play on schedule, so you become an isolation route team. But when Green Bay struggles, usually the reason why is the guys aren't getting open and Rodgers is playing too far off of schedule. So
yeah,
there's a fine line here to play. That's the tricky part with Aaron Rodgers. And it's not tricky when he's dominating, but when he's not throwing the ball consistently, which he hasn't for much of this season, then it becomes a fine line of whether the isolation routes are worth it or not. And they've done less isolation routes too lately. They've done more. He played on schedule against Tennessee last week, and then tonight against Washington, they did do more man-beater stuff off the line of scrimmage. They still wind up running fairly isolated routes after that, but at least they're starting to help the guys off the line of scrimmage a little bit.
Yeah. A little more Jared Cook tonight. I was really happy to see Jared Cook. I'm the last Jared Cook believer out there.
No, I am. I wrote right before he hurt his ankle that guy is a difference maker in this offense, the way they're using him. And then he got injured, and the whole thing went away. I'm with you. I think he can be the problem is, privately, guys who've had Jared Cook, who've coached him, say he's a coach killer because he does so many things well. You build around him,
yep.
And then tonight's a great example. They build around him. They put him at X ISO. He makes the plays. He was the difference maker. And then who's the one that fumbled the ball late in the game, right when they were about to get right in it in the final minutes?
Yep.
That's a microcosm. Tonight was a microcosm of Jared Cook's career. I like him, though.
I like him too. I always thought it was he was more a victim of circumstance, and you know, it was some bad Tennessee offenses and then some bad.
That's not how they feel about it. They feel he was the circumstance.
Man, poor Jared Cook. Last question here. This is coming from Brad Hesh at B Hesh 34. It's sort of a general question, and I'll let you handle this, Andy. But what do you see from Buffalo's defense? Stephon Gilmore said they play the most man in the league, most man coverage in the league. Is that a big problem?
It is in the when the guys don't play it well, which has been the case with Buffalo. It's not Gilmore; it's more Darby on the other side. He's had a tough year, a tough sophomore season for him. I think he's a good player, and it's been a tough year for him. It's kind of man coverage. A lot of it winds up quarters coverage that they play mostly, cover four. And we don't need to get into the details of it, but the way cover four often plays out, it turns into man-to-man. So they ask a lot of their guys, and it's almost always going to be man-to-man for those outside corners, which is where Gilmore plays. So, yeah, he plays more man coverage than just about anybody in the NFL. The interesting part is you don't always get to use the sideline as your help. Sometimes you play outside and have to play to the middle of the field. So
yeah,
they ask a lot of those cornerbacks. That's what they do, but that's why they draft them high. That's why they take Darby high in the second round. That's why Gilmore's a guy that someone's going to pay a lot of money to next year, and I think Buffalo will want to be in that race for him.
Mm-hmm. Nope. So that is it. That's your mailbag for this week, and we will move on to, before we move on, if you want to send something to the mailbag, you can do that, and we will answer it on the show. You can get us on Twitter, at ggramling_si, or Andy_Benoit, or you can get us on Facebook, just search for our names, or, if you get the podcast off of themmqb.com, we got the links right there. We got everything you need in one spot.
Number 9.
All right, that is it for the mailbag, and we are on to topic 9. This is the lightning round. A couple of good games that we haven't touched on yet. This is not one of those good games. The Steelers went to Cleveland and in the snow, as expected, got the win that they needed, broke their losing streak. Cody Kessler concussed. Some nice alliteration right there. And Terrell Pryor, unhappy about it after the game. This is the quote he gave. We can't keep letting our guys get hit. And when reporters asked him what should be done, he responded, why don't you talk to our management? It's a question for them. Somebody's got to say it.
Totally inappropriate for Terrell Pryor to say it. He's not the somebody to say it. Somebody who builds football teams ought to say it. Someone on the coaching staff can say it. Maybe a quarterback, a real one, not one that had to be converted to a wide receiver. They can say it, and whoever says it needs to say it privately. That is a totally destructive comment, and he's also thrown his teammates under the bus when he does that.
Yeah, even for a guy who's about to get paid? Might be getting
What's
out of there
guy?
Anyway?
He's not getting paid to have his opinion on the offensive line shared.
All right.
He's getting paid to develop, and by the way, the team who's developed him is the reason he's getting paid. The Browns have believed in him and been patient, and nobody came out and said, we need a wide receiver that actually knows how to run routes. No one came out and said that when Pryor was first learning, and he's still learning how to do this stuff. That's a selfish comment. How about the Minnesota-Arizona game, Gary? It's interesting that the Lions are in first place of the North. They're tied with the Vikings. Both of those teams scored on a return touchdown and special teams, Cordarrelle Patterson in this game, and then a pick six. And it was a crucial pick six for Xavier Rhodes. He went 100 yards on that.
Yeah, it was, when your offense is struggling, it's nice to get 100-plus yard touchdowns from the defense and from special teams. O-line for the Cardinals, really bad again.
It's a problem. They've had injuries, but now it's not the guys that have been hurt that are playing poorly. Wetzel, at least of the games I've seen, has not been the issue. Upati at left guard has struggled. Humphreys is inconsistent. Warford, the right guard, has had issues. It's been a very, very bad-looking offensive line for the last month now.
Point. Upati and Humphreys, those are the big-ticket guys. That's your big free agent and your first-round pick.
They're not playing well right now.
How about in Indianapolis, the Colts, right back in the thick of things in the AFC South, big win over the division rival Red Hot Titans, Exotic Smash Mouth. Sort of they cut them off of the knees of this one. They never got it started, and the Colts hang on. It wasn't beautiful. They made some. They caught a nice break on a fourth down play on a fourth and goal from the 2 that maybe they shouldn't have been going for. Actually, I think it was a 4th and 1 from the 2, but ball that should have been intercepted ended up being deflected to T.Y. Hilton. But the Colts do get the win. They hold on 24-17 in this one, and you know, they're right there. If the Texans start slipping a little bit, this is going to be the Colts' division.
Yeah, do not rule out the Colts just on the strength of their quarterback. He hasn't been talked about as much this season, but Andrew Luck is still one of the easily 5 best, and I'd say 3 or 4 best quarterbacks in the NFL, and that's the reason this team's got a shot. That's the reason they're up at 500 despite a lot of the issues that they've had. And in this game, they held on to win. In the past, we've seen them recently have to come back against Tennessee to win games. So these teams play each other tough, but Indy seems to be the one that always comes out on top.
Yeah, yeah.
Eagles and Seahawks today. That's kind of a big game in the NFC. It was a late window game. A couple of bird teams up there in the Pacific Northwest, and it worked out much better for Seattle. Are you concerned though about Procise got hurt in this one? Their breakout running back. Is there anything
this
to be worried
is,
about?
Yeah,
there?
The god of running backs sort of reached down and gave the Seahawks a little smack in this one. Procise goes down. They just let go of Christian Michael, and it seemed like they sort of used Michael up and then sort of like, you know, just sort of discarded him, which is what you do with running backs in this league now. But Procise goes down. Troy Maine Pope, who had just been pulled up from the practice squad, he gets hurt in this game. At the very end, Trevon Boykin, the backup, the rookie backup quarterback, was actually lined up at tailback when the Seahawks were running the clock at the end of this game, and it didn't work out particularly well. They did a little read option, and Russell got something before they punted. But, they are, suddenly kind of thin. Obviously, Thomas Rawls came back. He looked good. Andy, can I make one more complaint about the Eagles' receivers? Because I think I haven't complained about them enough this year.
Go for it.
So they had this beautiful, when the game was still competitive, Eagles had a beautiful draw play drawn up for Zach Ertz, ended up going for a 40-something yard touchdown. Called back because Nelson Aguilar on the trip side of the formation was not on the line of scrimmage. And I noticed this during the game, and I saw it getting passed around Twitter a little bit. Doug Peterson is about, whatever. They're on the Eagles sideline lined up there, so Peterson is however far that is, maybe 10 yards from Aguilar, just going nuts at him, telling him to move up and get on the line of scrimmage. And even the ref is signaling to him, like, you got to move up, you got to move up. And as soon as the ball was snapped, you just see Peterson just turn in disgust. And of course, he watches his beautiful play go for the long touchdown and all for naught.
Aguilar's a free spirit. He's a free spirit.
They got to start borrowing some exotic Smash Mouth stuff and just start running the 3 tight end stuff. Those receivers were brutal again today. Drops and not getting open and nasty stuff. But nice win for the Seahawks. They're cruising in the NFC West right now. And wrapping up, the upset of the day. Bucks go into Kansas City and come away winners. I don't know if you start to get worried about this Chiefs offense. I mean, I know you're not a big Alex Smith guy, but the Chiefs have really not gotten anything going either of the past 2 weeks at this point.
They haven't. They can scheme their way through that a little bit, but not always, and their defense has hidden the struggles, but that wasn't the case in this game. And now the Buccaneers are 5-5, and Jameis Winston really hasn't played great football yet. And I think just knowing him and knowing the way that offense is constructed and how they work with him there, I think it's reasonable to think he will play great football at some point. I think he can build on success. And what will this team look like if that starts to happen? They've got Doug Martin back healthy now, too.
Mm-hmm. No, we all were sort of watching Falcons and Panthers, and do the Panthers have time to catch the Falcons and all that? But Bucks are sitting right there, 5-5, game back.
Number 10.
Time for the awards, Andy. The weekly awards, Topic 10. We will start with Offensive Player of the Week. Who do you want to go first? Do I go first? Flip the coin.
I'll go first, and I'll go with Ty Nsekhe, the left tackle, fill-in left tackle,
yeah,
to Washington, handling Nick Perry, and then more often it was Clay Matthews. And to go one-on-one as a left tackle and win is a big deal. And Nsekhe did that last week against Everson Griffin, another good pass rusher, a guy who's struggling now, but a good one nevertheless. And earlier this season when he had to fill in and they moved Trent Williams to guard because there was a domino effect of injuries, he was good in that game as well. So there hasn't been a better off-the-bench lineman in the league than Ty Nsekhe this season. And 9 times out of 10, linemen off the bench get exposed because there's just not enough good ones in the NFL. This guy's gone the whole other direction. That he should get a lot of credit for that.
Nice. I'm giving it to Russell Wilson. I think the best thing for the Seahawks today was this was really the first week where this was their offense in full. They had Rawls back. They could sort of do all the things that they want to do offensively. And Wilson, you know, they use a lot of play action to sort of keep that pass rush at bay for the Eagles a little bit. And, you know, we saw him do it against the Patriots last week, but this Eagles defense is, a little more talent up front than what the Patriots throw at you. But, yeah, there's one great play Wilson had, total Russell Wilson play, scrambling left, hits Jimmy Graham on the sideline. Graham breaks a tackle, ends up running through the defense for a 35-yard catch-and-run touchdown, and it was kind of like, if you're a Seahawks fan, you just had to be like, yes, this is what it's supposed to be. So Wilson was fantastic today in a nice win over the Eagles, and they are looking really good right now. Who you got for Defensive Player of the Week?
I have Miles Killebrew for the Lions. He's been their dime safety this year. Doesn't play a ton, but when he comes in, he can play different spots in the field. He had a lot of success at different spots in this game. I think he's best as a dime linebacker, at least that's where I've seen him the most. But he had at least four that I can remember, individual third down stops in this game, playing dime against Jacksonville. He's going to have a bigger role as the season moves on. That's a more multiple defense than people realize there in Detroit. They do more things with more packages than you might guess.
I couldn't get the story off the ground, but last March or so, I wanted to do a piece on the fact that Southern Utah had two draftable defensive backs in this in this 2016 draft. Killebrew went round 4 to the Lions, obviously, and LaShawn Sims, a corner, to the Titans in round 5.
Oh, and Sims got in the game last week, too. They actually they played 5 snaps, and Green Bay went right after him, and they quite enjoyed themselves. That may have been how Green Bay got its offensive rhythm back, in fact.
Yeah.
But Sims was on the field, at least.
Yeah. Well, Southern Utah Thunderbirds football. I'm excited by it. We should have done that story. My defensive player of the week is Jason Pierre-Paul. This was sort of a vintage JPP type of game. I think it's the best game that he's had since he came back. He had 2.5 sacks. He had a forced fumble, and this was a really nice day for him. And now my favorite part of the show, Andy, who's your special teams player of the week?
I'm going to go with Washington kicker Dustin Hopkins. And on a day that we had the record set for most extra points missed, I believe Hopkins only missed 1 extra point.
That's pretty good. You're going to run out of these. We still have we have a lot of time to go here. We're doing playoffs too. There's going to be awards. But that was a good one. My special teams player though, I'll give it to Cordero Patterson for the long kickoff return that the Vikings needed because they can't do a whole lot on offense right now. And how many times we'll have Irwin go back and find the stat, but how many times has a special teams player of the week victimize the Arizona Cardinals?
Yeah, good point.
Especially that week where
they've had a tough year there.
I was going to say, especially the week that you named special teams player of the week everybody but the Cardinals long snapper.
Yeah, I felt bad about that, but sometimes you've got to make the tough calls. And it was nice that I didn't know his name, so I just called him Cardinals long snapper, which now would mean something totally different, because didn't they replace that guy?
They did, yeah.
Yeah. My coach of the week, I'm going to go with Jay Gruden in Washington, and probably trickles down to Sean McVay a little bit because he's the guy that calls the plays. But an aggressive game plan is always an impressive one. They saw a weakness in Green Bay's defense up the middle, especially once the linebackers up the middle started getting hurt, and they exploited it. They went right after it. And I also thought it was a very gutsy, in fact, gutsy to the point of foolish, but it worked out, so I guess he gets credit. It was a gutsy call to go for it on fourth down and one on that final drive, or what essentially was the final drive, the go ahead by two scores drive in the fourth quarter there. But they did that. Kirk Cousins got it. I go Jay Gruden.
Nice. I'll give it to Dirk Koetter. Bucks are, you know, we talked about just a couple minutes ago, but Bucks are now 4-1 on the road this year. And that, you know, they had upset of the day over the Chiefs, and they won at Atlanta this year, too. So they're getting it together when they have to travel. Good for Dirk Koetter. We'll send you your ceremonial plaque, key to the city. I don't know which city, but...
Someone pointed out to me, because I had lunch with Koetter in the off season, because he's an Idaho guy. And we were in the same town for a while. And I relayed the message. The lady wanted me to just tell him one thing, and that is that he has the best name for his job of anybody in America. Because I guess a dirk is kind of like a knife or something you stab with. And he's a Dirk Koetter, and he coaches for the Buccaneers. You know, Buccaneers would have that kind of a weapon.
That's pretty good. Did you tell him?
Yeah, I did. I said, that's the kind of stuff that I hear from my friends and family. And he appreciated that. He knew what a Dirk was. He hadn't thought about how it relates to his last name. And then the team that he's coaching now, of course, that's what put it over the top. That's why I had to bring it up.
There you go. Well, that's a nice note to end it on. And Andy, that is the end of our show. Thank you, as always, to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, and to the folks at Digital Media who always make us sound so good. Thanks most of all to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. Andy and I want to hear from you. Please contact us. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGramling_SI. You can also find us on Facebook. We legitimately do love hearing from you. We don't just say that. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.